And we're rolling with Nixon and the Watergate scandal. So the extensive outline that I have there for you in pink. Let's start on the very last item to refresh your memory. Three widely corrupt presidential administrations in U.S. history. Nixon's is the third. So, Grant, Harding, and Nixon. The corruption of Grant and Harding is different than the corruption of Nixon for two reasons. And I provided you there with Grant and Harding the big scandal. There were several under Grant, you know that. There were several under Harding, you know that. But thinking ahead, maybe, to the national exam, you know, the national exam likes examples, right? Especially on the short answer. So those would be good examples to provide for corruption under Grant, corruption under Harding. All right. The corruption of Grant and Harding was apart from the presidents. In other words, Grant and Harding were not personally involved. And I've said this before, this is the third time now, that still doesn't relieve them of responsibility, but nevertheless, they were not involved. In fact, both were frustrated about that, corruption because it occurred among many of their appointees. And let's be real about this. Many presidential appointees are maybe more friends than they are qualified appointees. All right, so that means what I'm trying to say here is that some of that corruption came at the hands of their friends, their trusted friends. Whereas with Nixon, Nixon was heavily involved, and I'll mention that in just a moment again. If not from the very beginning, then by the second page of the story. Second big difference, the corruption of Grant and Harding is all about what most corruption is about, ultimately, and that's money. Somehow, some way, I'm putting some money in my pocket. Whereas with Nixon, it was a lust not for money, but for political power. And that makes it especially alarming, especially dangerous, because participants in the corruption under Grant and Harding were not trying to undermine the government, whereas those under Nixon were. So, back then to the beginning of the pink outline. So, there's some preliminary work. Nixon didn't just wake up on a Tuesday morning and decide, I'm going to be involved in something corrupt, right? I mean, that doesn't happen. There's got to be something, there's a character flaw from the very beginning. So there are some events that need to be mentioned prior to the actual event. And that's the secret plumbers. So Nixon had a system of covert surveillance of what he viewed to be political obstacles. It could be other politicians. It could be the media. It definitely was the Democratic Party. The Pentagon Papers. So here is a disgruntled federal employee, Daniel Ellsberg. And he is going to turn over some information he has. Supposed to be pretty high-level, top-secret information to some newspapers. I have them listed there. And they will read this business that comes to be referred to as the Pentagon Papers, and, well, wow, there's some stuff here the American public needs to know, and they will publish it, and it involves government deceit about Vietnam. So America now has become aware that the federal government has deceived the American public about Vietnam, all the way back to Truman. Well, how does that bother Nixon? That in and of itself does not. But Nixon sees that if this sort of stuff, government papers, government business, government secrets, can be so easily brought before the American public, well, then that's going to bother me, because I'm the kind of guy that has a lot of secrets from the American government. So Vietnam War today, which, you know, I'm good on that, but tomorrow and the next day, who knows? So that's why it was bothersome to Nixon. He, two key names then are E. Howard Hunt and G. Gordon Liddy. And you can see that they are ex-government employees in just the sort of businesses, CIA and FBI, that are perfect to head Nixon's group of plumbers. And then these plumbers will not only attempt to plug leaks in the government, but then they will also turn into, that's the third bullet there, they will also turn into part of the mechanism for Nixon's re-election in 72. And now we go to the actual event that becomes the Watergate scandal. At the Watergate complex, that is a huge structure in Washington, D.C., and it has stores, it has apartments, it has offices, a lot like the Clock Tower Plaza that you all drive by. If you're going from here to Bacon Park, you'll drive right by it. So a lot like that, but of course on a much grander scale. So at 2:30 in the morning on June 17th, 1972, five burglars were caught. And it was, looking back, well, even at the time, but looking back especially, it's classic Saturday Night Live material. Because here are these five burglars, you know, former CIA agents, FBI, working, you know, at the highest level of government, the president, and they're just in an office going through files, you know, flashlight. And then who catches them? The security guard, just, you know, the Barney Fife kind of guy, just walking down the hall, and he looks in and sees, you know, a light flashing around and catches these guys. And so they're arrested. The office that they were in, the files that they were going through, were files of the Democratic National Committee. Nixon's a Republican. Nixon is looking for dirt on the Democratic Party, and especially key leaders of the party that might run against him in the election of 72. Here's the irony. And, well, there's a lot of ironies about this, but here's one of them. Nixon had the election sewn up. And I'm sure I'll mention that again later. The Democratic Party was in disarray. There was no Democrat out there who was going to defeat Nixon. I know I've said this before, but it's been true before. And it was true this time. All Nixon had to do to be reelected in 72 was just stay alive. But and so then, initially, we're off into Roman numeral 2 there, cover up and exposure. Initially, of course, this is in the headlines of newspapers, but it's like, I mean, it's no big deal. I mean, there's an office building in the Watergate, some burglars, okay, all right. Yeah. It wasn't even on the front page of anything. It's not like big headlines. And there is a bit of a connection because of who the five guys are with the federal government. Like, what are these guys doing? What, I mean, five guys just don't come off the street and create a burglary like this. Nixon will make some initial statements. He'll call it a third-rate burglary. He was right about that. He'll call it a bizarre incident. And America doesn't, sort of goes along with that. Nixon will also block FBI investigation. So here is the point where I said this earlier, where Nixon is now involved. So if you want to argue that Nixon was not involved from you know, the first sentence of the first page, but by the second page of the Watergate scandal book, he's in it. He's encouraging cover-up. And as far as that initial involvement, I mean, how about if I have a group and I say, here's what I want done. And then I just sort of leave the room. I mean, don't tell me when, don't tell me how, but just get it done. I mean, does that mean I'm not involved? I mean, you know, I guess that's a little bit of a subjective opinion. I think, well, you are. And so that would be Nixon. But if you want to argue, well, he really was involved. He didn't actually tell those five gentlemen to go break into the Democratic headquarters on that evening. Okay, no, he didn't. But still, he's involved, and he has the mechanism in place. Yes, dear?
The idea you came up with your, you say what you want done, then you leave, is called plausible deniability.
Sure.
And it's basically, well, I don't know how you did it. I don't know when you did it. I don't know why you decided to go along with it. So I can't be held responsible because I didn't force you to do it. I just gave you a little nudge out the door.
Right, right. Yeah, you said that. You said that very well. Do you have a particular source that you would have gotten that explanation from? The answer is yes.
Yes,
you have two sources.
My parents are both lawyers.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, all right. Okay, so. But now, by now, certainly, we're on the second page of this book about Watergate, and Nixon is involved, as you can tell. He will urge aides to lie, and then there will be other actions as well. So the deceit has started, and it's going to balloon. As I said once or twice already, there's no public connection with Nixon and this incident. 1972. This is an election year. So 6 months after this break-in happens, Nixon's going to be reelected. And that's because, how can that happen? It's because even into the election, November, 6 months later, the American public had not made the connection. That's going to come afterwards. All right. In fact, in September, look at that, that's unbelievable. So September, June, July, 3-4 months later, according to a Gallup poll, 50% of the public was unaware of the break-in. I mean, that's how low-key it was. Like I said, it wasn't on the front page out there. It's like, okay. Into the picture comes Senator George McGovern of South Dakota, Democrat, and, well, you knew that, right? Because it says liberal, right? And you associate in terms of politics, the Democrats are more liberal than are the Republicans. You know that. All right. In fact, George McGovern is considered to be one of, if not the most, liberal presidential candidate in recent history. In fact, when Obama was running, there were descriptions of him. When, before he was the actual Democratic candidate, and he was, it was, you know, primaries, so he's one of several. I remember hearing him described as the most liberal Democrat running for the presidency since George McGovern of South Dakota did it in 1972. All right. And as it turns out, so into the picture comes McGovern, and he has expressed that he's, you know, very interested in the presidency. The Democratic Party, I said this earlier, at this time is without leadership. Or there's too many leaders. I mean, you know how that goes. We don't have a leader here. Or I guess everybody's a leader, which kind of means you don't have a leader. So there's a great political cartoon, I don't know, I've seen it lately, I don't know where it is right now. A great political cartoon about this, and it shows several of the leading Democrats, like 10 or 12, and all of them were nationally known, McGovern among them. But none of them sort of, you know, rose above the bunch. Okay, I think we've had that going on lately, too. Maybe with both parties? I don't know. Just my opinion. Okay. Hope I didn't step on anybody's toes there. For the first time in this upcoming election, this is important, the 26th Amendment will take effect. The 26th Amendment lowers the voting age from 21 to 18. So when I was in your position, it was 21. Now, you know, 18 for you all, which means all of you are going to be able to vote next time the presidential election rolls around. So, once the toothpaste is out of the tube, you know, you've heard that, you can't put it back in, right? And that's what begins to happen from several sources. First of all, from the Washington Post, two reporters, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, very young at the time, begin to piece together some information. There's some phone numbers. They called papers that were, somehow they got access to these that one of these burglars had on their possession, I think. And like phone numbers, what phone number is this? I don't know. Well, let's find out. Let's call it. They called it, and guess what? It was the White House. So something as, you know, silly as that, it's almost Hollywood, isn't it? It's like, ah, come on. But that's the way it happened. So then it clicked. It's like, you know what? There's more to this than what America thinks right now. And so they will pursue this event, this break-in, and they get huge credit for exposing this to the public. Remember the muckrakers? Oh, I was doing that in my morning classes. The muckrakers exposing to the American public. They were investigative reporters. They were modern-day muckrakers. They will manage to expose to the American public what the American public, well, 50% don't even know about, let alone know the degree of involvement of the president and other members of the government. And they do this when they're fairly young. And they're both still around. They're both still alive. But it turned out to be, this is just, you know, one of those silly things in life. But imagine in whatever career you're going to go into, that when you are 24, you are going to accomplish your
all the things,
the big thing in your career, and then after that, it's like you can't you can't do any more after that. And that's kind of where they have been. So early on in their career, that's what happens. And then, you know, they've just kind of floated the rest of the way. And I don't mean that as a negative toward them. It's just, you know, just an interesting thought, or at least I think it's interesting. There was another secret source that came out and advised Woodward and Bernstein, and this secret source was one of those mysteries of history. It was never revealed. On and on and on and on, and until recently, I've been telling ape pushers that there have been several guesses. This was an interesting part of history that, well, we know this, we know this. Now, this person had to have access to a certain level of information. And so it can't be this person because they didn't have access to that. And so there were lots of educated guesses about who the secret source really was. And the only people that knew that were the secret source, him or herself, Woodward, Bernstein, and their publisher, Bradley was his name. And they all had pledged not to reveal the identity until after the person had passed away. Well, guess what? That secret source is on the... it's on the last page. Click pretty near the bottom, or under Roman numeral 3. Lasting images. W. Mark Felt revealed himself in 2005 that he was that secret source. And guess what? It was huge disappointment. Because nobody knew who this guy was. It's like, what? I mean, people are thinking, you know, the Secretary of the Treasury or the National Security Advisor or the head of the FBI. And what? Who is this guy? Turns out he was an FBI, a fairly high-ranking FBI agent, officer, and he was denied a promotion. And so he was bitter because of that, and that's what caused him to become this secret source. But that was a huge disappointment. I liked it when there was a mystery, when we didn't know who it was. Okay, and then... I have under the Washington Post there, back to the first page, John Mitchell was the Attorney General at the time. Let's see now, Attorney General. Head of the Justice Department. He operated a slush fund, and we're talking, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. And he was the real mastermind behind a lot of what was going on. Woodward and Bernstein will later write a book, and there will be a movie based on the book called All the President's Men. Well, in the election occurs in November of 72. And again, the American public was unaware of Nixon's involvement. That's why Nixon won the election in such a landslide manner. We'll come back and do the election later on, if we have time. But I want to stay with Watergate. So then it becomes increasingly, Nixon's involvement becomes increasingly suspect. And so in the winter and spring, there were government hearings. John Sirica will control the investigating committee, and he later will be awarded Time Magazine of the Year. Some other key names there, Sam Irwin and Loyal Weicker. And then, you know, like it happens so many times, there are the rats start jumping off the ship. And so, because they think, well, you know, it's over. And so there begin to be a few of those members of Nixon's cronies who are going to start to talk. And one of them was John Dean. And he'll begin to say, you know, well, here's what happened. Nixon people had an enemies list. that included, I don't know if you recognize any of those names, but it included actors, actresses, that would be Cosby and Paul Newman, and then sports stars too. Joe Namath was the Tom Brady of the time. He was on the so-called enemies list of Nixon's Republican Party. And then guess what? Oval Office tapes. As it turns out, Nixon had been recording all of his conversations that took place in the Oval Office. And nobody really knew this or thought about this until this guy, Alex Butterfield, who really wasn't a very high-ranking member of the government, just happened to mention it. And somebody, what? What? Tapes? There's tapes he's been recording? Well, then that's going to tell a lot. So the government, the investigative committee, will subpoena those tapes. That means it will force to surrender. How's that? Pretty good? Okay. Whatever. So in this case, Nixon, you must turn over those tapes. Well, he refuses. He will cite executive privilege, meaning, look, the executive, the president, you've heard that before, right? The president doesn't have to do everything that every other American has to do. And that's valid. When you're talking about parking spaces or something like that, I mean, the president should get a break. There's no doubt about it. He got the toughest job in the world. So the president does deserve a few breaks. He deserves a discount rate at Budget 8, Super 8 Motel, you know, and all that kind of business. But when it comes to withholding evidence, no. So he agrees to turn over edited transcripts. He said, okay, all right. Look, I'll have my people do transcripts and turn those over to you. Well, let's see. You mean you'll adjust those a little bit, take out the bad spots, you know? I mean, come on. So that's not good enough. So Supreme Court, U.S. versus Nixon, forces him to turn over those tapes. A Supreme Court ruling was necessary for that. One of those tapes has an 18 and a half minute blank spot. And his secretary, Rosemary Woods, takes the blame for that. She said, I hit the wrong button, or something like that. And it was believed that in that 18 and a half minute blank area that that was, you know, very, very damning conversation in terms of Nixon and his guilt. Well, there was plenty of it besides that anyway. And so there's one particular tape that's called The Smoking Gun. These tapes are public information now, and you can listen to them, and they're for a couple reasons, they're hilarious. Nixon, I think I've told you this, I said this yesterday, had a very distinctive voice, and he was a favorite for Saturday Night Live skits, and then he had some very colorful language, and not that, you know, I'm really into that, but, you know, every once in a while it can be kind of funny, and so to hear him on these tapes, they're actually kind of funny. And so his support in Congress went down the tubes. Even his most loyal supporters, Republican supporters, like, you know, they all said, you're done. And so then, he will resign the presidency in order to avoid certain impeachment and certain conviction. I mean, the writing's right there on the wall, so how do I want to go down at this moment? How do I want to go down in history? Do I want to go down as the only president ever removed because of a guilty verdict in an impeachment process? Or do I want to resign and sort of beat it? You know what I'm saying? So he, you know, takes the lesser of two evils and he will resign. However, In the meantime, his vice president, Spiro Agnew, resigns. Now, this indicates, or supports anyway, the thoroughness of the corruption of the Nixon administration. Because, well, yeah, let's see, he resigned. Remember, only one other vice president's ever resigned. That was Calhoun under Jackson, and that had nothing to do with improper behavior. Well, improper as far as Jackson is concerned, right? A lot of people think, yeah, his vice president resigned too. Yeah, something about Watergate there. No. His vice president, Spiro Agnew, resigned on because of actions apart from Watergate. As it turns out, as governor of Maryland, before he became vice president, he had accepted bribes and had not paid taxes as he should, and then committed those same offenses as vice president, and so forced to resign, and he will, as he resigns, he just refuses to accept responsibility. He calls that action, he calls himself a victim of heightened political morality. So, in other words, politicians should be able to accept bribes and cheat on their income tax. I mean, Agnew, is that what you're saying? Well, yeah. So then here comes to the presidency, I'm sorry, to the vice presidency, Gerald Ford. I mean, Nixon has to replace his vice president with somebody. So Gerald Ford of Michigan is the new vice president. And then, as it turns out, when Nixon resigns, Ford moves into the presidency. So Ford, and they didn't quite take this far enough, and then in the election of 76, Ford is defeated by Carter. So Ford is the only president to have never served, to have never been elected vice president or president in our history. Nixon was also guilty of tax evasion, misuse of funds, in addition to the Watergate business. And so then, 9 o'clock in the evening on August 8th, Nixon will resign. Beating then, charges that would certainly have been brought against him by the House, and confirmed then later on by the Senate. First ever Time magazine editorial. Imagine that would have taken quite an event for a publication such as Time to do something for the first time ever. Time is a reputable publication. And that first editorial ever is all about Nixon, should resign. When Ford is, after Ford is inaugurated, one of his powerful statements is, "Our long national nightmare is over." Yeah, well, yes and no. All right, stay tuned. Nelson Rockefeller becomes the new vice president under Ford. And then Ford... Well, I guess the national nightmare isn't quite over. Because Ford then almost immediately grants Nixon full, free, and absolute pardon, which he did not do to any of the other conspirators. They all will serve jail time, but not Nixon. Ford's popularity plummeted because of that. He never recovers, and that's part of the reason he loses the election to Jimmy Carter. It's unfortunate because Ford was a pretty good guy. I'm not saying an outstanding president. I'm saying a good guy. He was to Nixon what Coolidge was to Harding. Just real, remember after Harding, the corruption, the partying, the womanizing, America wanted with Coolidge just down-to-earth, honest guy. And that's what Coolidge was. And Same thing with Ford. That's certainly what Ford was, even though he wasn't elected, but nevertheless, right man at the right time. So he was a good guy, but nevertheless does not recover from this pardon that he grants Nixon. So the aftermath of the Watergate scandal is... I'm checking time here. Uh-oh. Better go to... not going to be good. Darn it. And I pushed the wrong button. Okay.